Welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. This is CJ Wilson with Josh Olsiewicz, and we are going to be diving into some of the worldwide events right now and talk about how Bitcoin seems to be the safety net. I don't know. This is kind of crazy. It's pretty volatile out there, man.
Yeah, it's kind of odd that it feels like the world is falling apart in multiple countries, like just their currency, like let alone everything else that's going on, obviously, but currencies just appear to be collapsing based on the government's own management, you know, central banker management, either in Japan or in England, just a complete mess across the board. England, so the queen dies and England falls apart. Like, she was the glue holding all that together, I guess.
Right. Well, in the last couple of days, we've seen the euro cross under the dollar, and we've seen the pound kind of go all the way down to almost parity with the dollar. You know, we're at that point where it's threatening parity. And I guess the dollar is ripping right now. And that's been murder on a lot of people. It's been murder on the stock market. It's been murder on a lot of things. But it seems like Bitcoin kind of front ran the recession a little bit by dropping in price, and now has sort of sitting on a bottom. I don't know if this is the bottom, but it's kind of just kind of ranging between like $1,000 range, between it kind of 18 and a half and, you know, 19 and a half. And we're just seeing that sort of catch. And then the falling knife of the Bank of England, you know, currency and the euro have just like been, I think it's really shaken a lot of people because they're used to seeing it in, you know, like not in my backyard. Now here it's happening in their wallet, in their accounts.
Yeah, I think what scares people about crypto is the volatility, especially legacy TradFi people. So like you said, when it's in their own backyard, they, I think rightfully so, are questioning their investments in a different way than they had been. You know, the bond markets have done worse historically than they ever have. The pound is down to an all-time low, and that's not like an emerging market currency.
That's an all-time low.
UK. That's an all-time low.
I was talking to my wife the other day about it, and I said, babe, this is a huge deal with how devalued the pound has become against the dollar. And she says, well, how big of a deal is it? I said, it's literally never happened. It's never been this, like, I remember a couple of years ago, maybe 2015, 16, something like that, it went down to like $1.17. And that was so huge of a thing that I was able to like literally buy cars from the UK, import them, pay the taxes and everything, and then sell them and still make a profit. Like, that's how big the arbitrage gap was. This is almost like, you know, the early days of a Bitcoin exchange where, you know, these exchanges effectively are trading assets at completely different values. And you can just by having enough liquidity, you can slide some of the stuff across. So I think some of these people that are big, big, big asset allocators are having a hard time figuring out where is the safe haven and what do they do?
Yeah, I saw Forex traders comparing it to a casino because the volatility is just crazy for them to see what they're seeing, and they don't know what to do. They don't know if like intervention is going to make a difference. It doesn't make sense to me that based on what the Bank of England has been doing, just printing money and then buying their own bonds, why the pound is up instead of continuing to fall. But it is what it is, right? It's recovered a little bit, but it doesn't change like their course of action.
But that was the first macro pivot of any of the central banks, though, right? Because the central banks kind of in lockstep a couple of years ago said, okay, we're going to kind of ease and we're going to put more money into the system, trying to stimulate the economy and try to save people or something like that during the lockdown periods. Then all of a sudden they said, okay, we're going to, not all of a sudden, but you know, after about 20 months of that, they're like, okay, we're going to start paring back. We're going to decelerate the easing, you know, because they were still doing it at $50 billion a month or something crazy. Then they started to tighten, right? And then they're starting to let less out the door every month, but we still didn't get into the point of actually tightening. And now we're starting to get to tightening, you know, in the last 90 days or whatever, and things are starting to get really like wobbly. And then the Bank of England just goes, oh, we don't like this. We're going to start doing some stuff. But it was an emergency intervention, basically, right? With the pension fund?
Yeah, I guess their pension funds were at risk of being margin called, which is a crazy. I mean, we think about crypto and like a couple billion dollars. It's pretty small in the grand scheme of things. Forex is trillions. Who that affects is everybody, right? Like across the globe.
Who that affects? Everybody.
It's a little different than Bitcoin and digital assets. So that was apparently like they were teetering on the verge of just total meltdown. And then BlackRock had to step in and say, hey, you guys need to do something. BlackRock is a big TradFi powerhouse. I don't even know how to describe them other
I mean,
than.
BlackRock manages or has access to between $7 and $10 trillion, depending on the day, right?
Yeah.
So something like that. So like in the grand scheme of things, BlackRock itself as a sort of monolithic entity is 7 to 10 times the entire crypto market in terms of just gross exposure,
Which
right?
is a
Or
silly, it's a silly metric anyway to look at the total crypto market cap, because a lot of that's just you and I could make CJ coin and make it 10 million tokens at $10 and it'd be whatever valuation. So it's kind of silly to even look at the total crypto market cap. But yeah, you're right. It is several multiples above the
right.
entire ecosystem of crypto for sure.
Right. Which has, I mean, taken a big hit, obviously, in the last, 7 months or something like that. But I think what's really, I think, exposed to people that are not Bitcoiners, that are not crypto people at all, is okay, their eyes are opening wider and wider to the reality that there are people that are literally manipulating the money supply, literally manipulating the bond yields, literally manipulating all these factors that, like you said, is exposing their life's work in a pension that they've been working for forever to supreme volatility that they're not used to and they don't want. And that's kind of the problem with some of these pension funds and stuff like that. Anyways, is they're literally passengers on a train being driven by 20 people worldwide. And, someone can pop the train tracks off and then everybody crashes.
Yeah, and we already had dollar strength going into all of this, which didn't help the pound or the euro. But you have obviously the war in Ukraine and the Russia stuff and the energy stuff. This pound weakness was more related to recent policies that their government was implementing based on new leadership over there.
Right.
So
Like
it wasn't even
literally.
like dollar strength, it was just based on what they were doing in their own backyard.
Well, I think, whoever panics first makes the safe move, right? So you have all these central banks, Japanese central bank, Chinese central bank, you've got the IMF, you've got the European Central Bank, you've got the Fed, the Bank of England, you've got all these kind of, I would say, in a way, they're leaning against each other, right? They're all leaning in to sort of like stabilize. That's the goal of this whole international monetary system. And as things become trendy or things become difficult or challenging or political or whatever, we typically see like a 5% or a 10% sort of like wick over a long period of time in between the Swiss franc and the euro, or the pound and the euro, or the dollar and the euro, or something like that. But now we're at the point where we've seen like 20 and 30% rips, where the dollar's up 20 or 30% relative to these other currencies in a super short period of time. And I think what it comes down to also, that's and this is what's kind of scary for a lot of people, they're sitting there thinking, hey, I'm just in my lane doing my thing. But suddenly my work is getting devalued because I'm buying this stuff from somewhere else. There's all these import export tariffs and all this other stuff. People don't really realize how interlinked all of these central banks are. And they're all kind of like in this, like they're the it's the war room, right? You have Yellen and Powell and Lagarde and the guy I always do memes of,
Klaus? No, not Klaus, the other guy.
no, Augustin,
Augustus,
August, yeah. So
Augustus
these
Pooh, or whatever
guys.
his name is, yeah.
Right. You have all these people at the International Bank of Settlements or whatever, and they're all kind of working together for better or worse, right? And they're kind of helping each other make these decisions. And then eventually you have, whether it's Larry Fink or Stanley Druckenmiller or one of these other whale allocator kind of hedge fund Wall Street people, they're weighing in on these types of things, and they're saving Deutsche Bank or not saving Lehman Brothers or something like that, right? So I think like we're starting to see that wobble, and every time that they miss time, meaning like like put an input into the system at the wrong time. If any of the central banks have bad timing, it just totally shakes people off and they get like speed wobbles and they can crash, you know, and that can be an asset that crashes, a sector that crashes, or it could be bonds, or it could be anything, right? And we've seen that in the past in America with housing market being really volatile, mostly because of loans and stuff like that. But now we're seeing that it's benefiting Americans in a way because our buying power for international purposes is going up. But the stability of the international like government complex is getting wobbly, right? And it's wobbly for all these reasons. And it's like kind of people, I think, really are starting to wake up to this.
Yeah. And since Bitcoin was created, the evidence for its existence and need continues to mount year by year, right? If it's not Greece this year, if it's not Eurozone, if it's not Ukraine, right? For XYZ reason, if it's not all the central bankers just mismanaging everything nonstop, you know, like there's a way to opt out. And it's not in a libertarian sense. It's just like, look, here's your choice. You can either play the game that they're playing or say no thanks and, you know, put your money in peace of mind elsewhere, right? Like that's really what it comes down to for me. It's like, okay, I don't want to think about all this other stuff because it's very scary, you know, when you're putting unelected officials in charge of the world's monetary system.
Right. And because the, just let's say commerce, right? So international commerce is a big thing. You have people building things in one country, shipping them across an ocean, distributing them through other countries, through these hubs and stuff like that. The reason why the euro works is because everybody sort of, it's like an open border system once you're in, right? You can just kind of drive through. There's no real passports needed. Like it's
have you been 25 here? Since what? They implemented the euro? Have you been there since they implemented the euro?
Oh yeah. 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 I usually go to Europe. I mean, before the COVID thing popped up, I was going to Europe probably twice a year for the past, like, you know, I would say 5 or 6 years, but once a year for the past 15 years. So I would go for an extended period of time after the baseball season, and I would stay there for like a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that, drive around, go hit some sites. I'm actually going out there later this year to go experience some of this stuff. But also in a way, I'm like mildly curious because I've never been to Europe when the dollar has been so strong. The first time I went to London was in 2007, and I went to see Manchester United play, and I went to see a Liverpool and Arsenal play. I'm a big sports guy, right? So the pound was $2. It was $2. So it was like, you know, you go buy a sandwich or something, you take a taxi ride, and it's like 40 bucks here, 40 bucks there. It was brutal. And now it's the opposite. I'm like, oh my gosh, like I kind of want to go there now because now my money is the strong one and I can go like have more fun, eat better, stay in nicer places, all that stuff. I think there's a lot of like quick adjustment that happens in the Forex world because people, they can recruit, you know, business from all over the world now, especially for anybody that can send you goods, whether it's a book or a hat or something like that. You know, being a vendor is good in terms of when there's currency volatility. It's really bad to be a producer though, because you don't know how much your labor is going to cost tomorrow. You don't know how much your parts are going to cost tomorrow. And I think like the countries that are really exposed by this are especially Germany, because they export so much stuff and it's big, heavy stuff like cars, and they're sourcing parts and materials from all over the world. And that's been a very big disruption in the last 2 years with the microchip stuff, but I think it's going to continue. And like you said, it's the fact that like, I don't really like the fact that Janet Yellen or any of these other people can manipulate my net worth or the value of my business or something like that. I don't like that. And that's why I like Bitcoin better. It's very simple.
Yeah. And I'm just looking at the euro too. And it's like you said, below a dollar. It's crazy that not even including like the euro and the pound, but like I used to visit New Zealand every once in a while, and that's at like 0.57. So you go to some places as an American and you just feel, even Canada, I think is like 0.75. The dollar is so strong right now, and that's hurting a lot of stuff globally for sure. And we're definitely feeling that in Bitcoin's price. And it's interesting if you pull up like a DXY chart, which isn't necessarily the dollar value. It's a relative value. People need to know that it's relative mainly to the euro and a few other things. But you know, you look at that chart, and it's just completely parabolic. So
right.
If the Eurozone starts to get their stuff together and the pound figures its stuff out, you know, maybe we start to see some relative dollar weakness, which historically has helped Bitcoin. It's helped crypto. Mm-hmm. Crypto is mainly really correlated to emerging market currencies historically, maybe not so much over the past couple of years, but how it ends up turning out is weakness in the dollar is great for Bitcoin, which mm-hmm. is why it's kind of surprising that Bitcoin is just sitting here, you know?
Well, it's a risk thing, right? So what happens is when you're an investor, you want to put your money in a diversified portfolio of risk so that you're not taking all risk all the time. Because if you're all risk all the time, when you need something and you might be timing it, the exit at the wrong part, and you might have to capitulate and sell the bottom. That's what's dangerous for a lot of people. And recently there's been some people that have had to sell the bottom, you know, in Bitcoin as a result of when they got in and stuff like that, or just not having enough income. So that's where it really is tough, because, you know, Bitcoin doesn't have a yield. Bitcoin doesn't have a, you know, a natural interest rate or something like that. So you have to manage your cash flow in order to operate. The problem is during inflation, your cash flow gets burned faster because the stuff that you want or need is just like, you know, accelerating. And I don't think that trend is going to go down, in the sense that I think inflation is here to stay for quite a while. I don't really care what they try to do with interest rates or something like that. If the CPI, which is still not totally representative of cost, if the CPI is 8-10%, something like that in certain places, then like, yeah, a 4% treasury bond or something like that, you know, 2 years, 10 years from now, something is not necessarily going to be an adequate decelerant. You know, it's not going to put the pump the brakes on, because I think if you want something or you need something, you have to buy it. And so then the question becomes asset allocation, right? And like, how bad do I need this? How bad do I want that? And like, why am I going to buy this first and that second? And then you start to make really hard choices when you start deselecting options from your menu. And I think investing, we haven't really seen that yet in Bitcoin terms. People were like all in on Bitcoin because it was, you know, risk on environment. It was, you could borrow money at 1 or 2% and then try Bitcoin. But now the interest rates are higher, and you can't borrow as much. Maybe there's less speculation on it, and there's more dollar cost average purchasing, or let's say pleb buyers or something like that, as opposed to the big huge.
We call them minnows.
Minnows, yeah, sure, more minnows, more shrimps and minnows. Yeah. And with the pound weakening, there's definitely a case for British people to start buying Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, that's what I was looking. I was pulling up the BTC GBP chart. And
right.
That looks even better than the USD chart does, right? Which is to say that, yeah, if like you're saying, if you've got pounds and you need a safer place to put your money, BTC is an option right now. You
know? Which has never really been the case on a broad level,
right?
To say that people haven't really thought of Bitcoin as the stable currency. They've thought of Bitcoin as the risk on currency. But now they're seeing that just having money in the bank is risk on, because someone can pull the lever, you know, and devalue or debase or, you know, whatever the technical term for it is. But I think that this is going to wake a lot of people up, right? A lot of people 25 years ago didn't understand Wi-Fi. Now everybody understands Wi-Fi, right? Everybody understands how to set a router in their house. They're downloading content. They're not buying CDs anymore. In the same sense, I think there's like just this generational shift that's happening, where the trust of these central authorities is going down across the board, because they keep making mistakes because they're human. And this is not even encountering the James Bond effect of like the dude in the scuba suit that blew up the pipeline, right? Like that's a whole nother element of manipulation, and we still haven't even, and that's, you know, that we're still very open to why, how, who, all those questions. All we know is when, a couple days ago, somebody blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. That's all we actually know, right?
Yeah, and where it happened and at what depth. But yeah, I mean, that, again, it's like with all this stuff going on, the stuff for Bitcoin, digital assets, got washed away, like the nonsense with Celsius and 3AC and Anchor, Terra. Like, they're still trying to hunt down Doquan.
Yeah, Interpol's Inc. after him now, right?
I haven't heard too much about Suzu and 3AC, but I imagine they're still looking for them as well. But I guess my point is, like, all the worst of the worst in Bitcoin land is gone, right? And, mm-hmm. and now we're just dealing with macro and geopolitical stuff and Forex volatility, right? And Bitcoin's just like, yeah, whatever. Like, okay.
You know? Right. And I think all of those things, meaning the macro geopolitics stuff, that's actually what Bitcoin was born for.
Yeah.
You know, the insider, not even insider, but I would say like the weird manipulative, like leveraging and stuff like that of Bitcoin, the cross collateralization of Bitcoin, I think really hurt the market in a lot of ways. And it really hurt the market in a sense that you still don't have that many people with that much liquidity ready to go, you know? And when we've seen Bitcoin sort of flatten out in the meantime, it dropped before everything else did. The stock market was still at 34,000-35,000 when Bitcoin tanked. Now the stock market and, you know, the Dow Jones is at like 29,000, right? So it's down 15-20% from the all-time highs.
Come celebrate Bitcoin winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from May 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your tickets before prices go up. The censorship-resistant issue of the Bitcoin Magazine print edition is available now. Grab your copy at your local Barnes & Noble store or head on over to the Bitcoin Magazine store and use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your order today. If you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts break down what's going on in the markets so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
But the question is, like, how much further can that fall before people start redeeming, right? Because we still haven't seen a run on 401ks. We still haven't, where people are like pulling out completely of, not even like risk on, but sort of like traditional conservative growth strategies or whatever, right? That's like the traditional 401ks. There has not been a run on 401ks, but there was a massive hiccup in the British version of that, you know, this week. So if I think the wise people are going to be like, whoa, wait, why did that happen? How did that happen? What could that happen here? And it's like, yeah, it could happen anywhere. Because if you have capital mismanagement, capital misallocation, then all of a sudden, you know, you're at risk, and there's a lot of, you know, unintended consequences from that retirees or whatever are going to bear the brunt of. And I don't really see a way around that right now, because anything you do to, like, quote, set rules or set limits or set prices or something like that, or stabilize things, that just adds more gravity to the system, more mass to the machine, and just means that when it breaks bigger and more spectacularly.
Yeah, one of the things we talk about a lot internally is, you know, if you want to go risk off and you have a broad spectrum of assets, like digital BTC digital assets is one of the first things you're probably going to sell, because it's fairly liquid. You can access it 24/7. And we think this is part of the reason why BTC dropped first, right? Before everything else, like you said, it kind of front ran everything. Mm-hmm. And it may also be on the flip side of that equation, like it may be something that people start to buy first, mm-hmm. when shit hits the fan, right? Like, because you can buy it on the weekend, you can buy it whenever you want. So one thing I'm closely going to be following into Q4, which is in a couple days, right? Happy October, mm-hmm. is how do we look on the weekends, like in Q4? How do we look on US off hours as far as markets are concerned? Because mm-hmm. if we start to see strength in there, in those off the US hours times, that's a good sign that momentum is starting to shift, especially in Q4 when we traditionally have seen stronger performance in Bitcoin.
I'm
just going to say it's lining up like for a potential of some sort of move.
For positive potential.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not like highly confident, but yeah. Sorry.
Well, we have to look at Bitcoin as it doesn't necessarily correlate completely, right? There have been risk on tech stocks while Bitcoin's going up, they're both doing well, something like that, and then they both drop, right? So you can say it's correlated. Someone's like, well, why don't I just buy Tesla or something like that? It's like, well, you can't spend your Tesla stock at the end of the day. That's a reason why people put a percentage, right? Maybe not all of their portfolio into Bitcoin, because that would be relatively irresponsible. But that's where like people tend to say, oh, well, you know, if I'm 80% stocks and 20% bonds or something like that, that's their actual portfolio, their wide ranging portfolio. Then they're like, well, what percentage should Bitcoin be? You know, and it's like, well, depends on what your goals are, right? But if your goal is to spend some of that money, you can spend 100% of your Bitcoin 24 hours a day, right? Whatever Bitcoin you have, you can spend it immediately, which makes it a money, right? Which is the whole point of Bitcoin. But it also makes it usable and more functional than holding a stock. The biggest problem I think that we have just with Bitcoin right now in general is that although it does make sense to like have as much as you can get, relatively speaking, you know, if you want it to be the money, you know, the international reserve currency or something like that, then we do need to be able to buy more stuff with it or engage in more financial products with it other than just buying, holding, you know, and then spending like for on Lightning or something like that. I mean, car payments, mortgage payments, Colorado is taking taxes now. You can pay your taxes in Bitcoin. I think that's awesome. I think it's interesting because there's a whole list of like people that are like, oh, security, you know, like privacy. But it's like, listen, if you want it to be the money, then you have to use it for all this stuff, right? You have to put, you have to be able to use it for all that stuff. And it's your choice if you want to spend dollars or Bitcoin. But I really feel like, you know, if there's a point where I can trade Bitcoin and I can take the Bitcoin off the exchange easily and then spend it somehow or sell it for dollars and send the dollars out, that's the hiccup right now. It's very hard to move a big pile of Bitcoin, you know, or a big pile of any crypto really, and then get dollars out of it, because you can't necessarily spend all of those different types of cryptocurrencies like for real stuff, right? So
that, it's like crossing the border, you know, like you're going from like the digital environment to the meat space, and that is a ton of friction between all of that, right? Because the digital space is so fluid. I can put anything anywhere in seconds, right? Mm-hmm. In any degree, in any form I want. But like you're saying, to get through that off ramp is just very painful. So for the tax example, like if I need to sell Bitcoin to pay my taxes, which I've had to do historically, like that's this tax, not advantage, but this tax option to pay taxes in BTC is huge for people who sort of denominate their life in BTC, because otherwise they're just continually taxed on taxes that they're paying, right? It's just this nonstop loop of paying costs,
you know, right? To pay taxes because you have to sell to pay your taxes,
right,
is the ultimate shot in the nuts. I think you know, that's the rock salt from point blank range at the, you know what I mean, like right in the gonads. And I think like if we get to the point where, you know, and this is what I had this conversation recently, right? This is a very important thing for people to realize. Using Bitcoin itself as a transaction method is the best. Like, so if you want to do a transaction, you can buy Bitcoin, send it to somebody, they can sell it for cash right away. And then, you know, it's more efficient doing that than it is using a 3% fee on, you know, Amex or something. That's like really mind blowing for most people, because they're like, well, yeah, but there's volatility in Bitcoin. It's like, well, not really in that time period between when you do the transaction and when it's confirmed and it's in your account, right? If you were going to be a business that ran on Bitcoin or used Bitcoin, like I have dollars, I have Cash App, let's say, right? I want to buy something for $500. I buy $500 for the Bitcoin right now. I pay you $500 for the Bitcoin right now. You receive it right now. You can sell $200 of it for cash, $300, or all of it for cash, whatever you want to do, right? It's your optionality at that point. And you might even have a metric or a system to like accumulate Bitcoin where you're like, okay, well, I'll take 3% myself of every transaction in Bitcoin or something like that, right? So you could do $100 million in transactions in a very short period of time and settle in Bitcoin and then settle in dollars on both sides of the transaction. So that's the thing that, like, I have to explain that to people when they're saying, oh, why can't you do this or that? Because you can, if you know what you're doing. It's not really that hard. You have like one or two mobile wallets, and then you have like a cold wallet, and you have like a real vault, a multi-sig vault or something like that. You could have these different layers, just like you have, you know, cash in your wallet, a credit card, a debit card, an account at a bank, or a loan on your house or something like that. There's all these financial layers. But right now, like, people still don't realize that, just like they don't realize you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin, just like they don't realize that, you know, Bitcoin's 24/7, just like, you know what I'm saying? So there's all these things that are still, like, we understand that as early adopters, but the other people don't yet. And so we have to really kind of tailor the message to say, hey, listen, it's not just like holding all of it all the time. You can sell some of it. You just have to understand that you have to catalog your cost basis, right? So if you sell it fast enough, then your cost basis is really, there's no tax there, so you're fine. And I think that's where, like, some regulation will clarify things, other regulation will hamper things. So it's like a very thin line on what's going to benefit Bitcoin and people. Really, benefiting people is more important than anything else, and that's we use Bitcoin to protect ourselves, you know what I mean? It's like, that's the right. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I remember in the bear market of 2015, I sound like an old sailor, but in previous bear markets, like, I would try to go out, not only learn myself, but try to teach people this stuff, right? Like, just the basics. And I'd go to like small businesses, and I'd like try to have people accept Bitcoin. And it was like, there's no way in hell they're accepting Bitcoin. But like, it doesn't matter. Like, I remember this experience, and looking back on it, it was a great experience. And I also tried to like give talks about Bitcoin. There's this, like, it's called a Brainery. I don't know if you've ever even heard of this, but it's where you go and like learn about random stuff. I tried to give a talk. Nobody showed up. Like, it was just, it's amazing, right? Because looking back on it, some of the small businesses that I talked to, I know some of the people still. And, you know, they were like, man, if I only would have listened to you in 2015 and started accepting Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Because they've told me, like, over the years, they've had people who've come to them and say, hey, do you take Bitcoin, right? Like, not many people, but there are people out there who denominate their life in BTC or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting that you're always trying to help people learn, and you're always trying to learn yourself. I remember like falling asleep to Andreas and Antonopoulos videos every night, right? Just like drinking the Kool-Aid or whatever it is, just trying to tell myself, like, this is why I'm here. I'm not necessarily here for the price. The price is great, obviously, the investing side of things. But back to like why we're here and why we're doing what we're doing, because it's, you know, it's an off-ramp for all this central banker shenanigans and mismanagement just globally.
Right. That's a great one. I like that. So it's, if we look at this conversation that we have with a lot of people, especially people that are not, you know, into it at all, that they always say, oh, so the only goal is you want to sell it at a higher price for dollars. And it's like, well, no, the idea, it's like, you don't have to sell. You don't want to sell. You want to hold it and figure out a way to use it and stay in that economy, you know, because that's how you, if you can provide value where you're getting paid in a new currency that's better than the dollar, and you can buy stuff in a currency that's stronger than the dollar, then that's how you work, right? That's where it is. And the stronger money, the scarcer money, the more valuable or more programmable money or whatever, pushes out the fiat money eventually. And the problem is that people like the fiat system. So many people like it. They like that loans are cheap, because it allows them to consume more stuff. And then that kind of functions in this weird feedback loop. But I was thinking about it today. I was trying to come up with the right way to say it. And it's like, the government wants a more productive machine, right? Economically, constantly. They're trying to ramp inflation on a steady scale. And they're trying to basically get more horsepower out of the engine. And the fuel that they keep dumping into it, which is like basically fiat money, allows the engine to keep running. But you also need more people, you know, more air in the engine to like keep it going, because there's a fuel to air ratio, where if you dump too much fuel in, then you choke the engine, right? And it literally like can't function. Combust. It can't function. Yeah. Because it's like it's a mixture that allows the most horsepower possible. That's and it's having that mix right is very important. The problem is that, like, if you don't tell the people what you're doing and you just dump a bunch of fuel in, then it's going to chug and, like, you know, lock up and have all these problems. And that's kind of where we're at right now, is that you had people say at the top, you know, just say, hey, you know what, we need more gas in the engine because that's going to help save what's going on. But they didn't really adjust the distribution of that in a way that benefited the total machine. And that's what's happening. So, you know, as you adjust, right, you say, oh, well, we need more air. You have too much air, not enough fuel. You know, and it's like this constant experimentation before it settles. And we're still at the beginning phases of that oscillation, where there's all this liquidity pumped into the system. There's not enough people spending it, using it, taking it out, because it's going to the wrong people. It's going too high, you know, or whatever in the food chain. And it's making some people receive more than they naturally would have. And so they're fine. They're getting richer. And then you have other people where their dreams or their possibilities or their earning power is going, because the wealthier people are gobbling up those resources before they can get to it. And that's the part that makes it really hard, when you combine the extra liquidity going to the wrong people who can then borrow against it, you know, like even faster at even lower rates. And that was kind of how we spiraled into this whole inflationary environment in the last 2 years. And all of us saw that. And then Janet Yellen comes out on posts on Twitter. She's like, yeah, it happened faster than we thought it was going to happen. We didn't think it was going to be this bad. We didn't see this happening for this long. And it's like, how could you not see that? Like, you gave the money to BlackRock. You gave the money to Wells Fargo, or, you know, whoever. You didn't give it to, like, Tom from down the street, you know. And there's a lot of people that got wrecked in this process. And so then that's one less player at the table. Anybody who goes through bankruptcy or folds their tent and loses their business during an economic problem, they are not there anymore. They're gone, right? And so that's where, like, they didn't think about that part of the equation when they started, like, you know, playing favorites in a way. So it's a very dystopian look at it, to say that people can't be trusted ultimately, you know. So
that's why we need, you know, separation of money and state at the end of the day. I'm not even, like, the super ultra-tarian, libertarian, like, leaning person, but it's like, look, we need to stop letting people do what they're doing, because they're people and they're going to make mistakes. And
right. If you give people too much power, what else could they possibly do other than get ruled by the power that they're given? Right. It's like the transformation from person in charge to person on a power trip is, it's a very short turn, you know? And I think we're seeing that. And the problem is that if someone's influencing that person, which also happens, like I said, cause they're all connected in their own weird nepotistic way, then that becomes a cyclical thing, you know? And it's not just like a one time.
Institutional too. It's not just a single person. That's how we get rates to zero for multiple years.
Negative rates.
And now having no way to dig out of it. We're living through it now. The whole experiment is about to blow up and we're living through it. So
yeah. So
I think we have to leave on that happy note today.
Yeah. So our safety net is Bitcoin, because at least we know what the rules are with that and nobody can mess with it.
Exactly.
So, you know, and as if we just have to keep doing what we like to do, which is, like, onboarding new people, onboarding merchants, so we can spend our Bitcoin and live off that standard, I guess, you know, in a way, and cook in our cast iron pans.
Just opt out in a non-violent way. Yeah.
Totally. Awesome, man. Well, I'm glad neither one of us are in trouble with this pipeline shenanigans, because I'm sure they're going to get somebody eventually for that. But so for those of you listening, not financial advice, but life advice, watch out for, don't go hanging around any oil pipelines. You don't want to be a suspect in any of these global cataclysms that are potentially happening. Do the best you can to protect yourselves, stay hydrated, and make sure you have extra layers for winter, because it's coming eventually, just like Game of Thrones.
Come celebrate Bitcoin winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from May 18th to the 20th, head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your tickets before prices go up. The censorship-resistant issue of the Bitcoin Magazine print edition is available now. Grab your copy at your local Barnes & Noble store or head on over to the Bitcoin Magazine store and use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off of your order today. If you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts break down what's going on in the markets so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.